Welcome back to the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett on Mondays and Fridays and Jim Fetzer the middle 3 days of the week. I am Morgan Reynolds, your guest host today, this fine Thursday, October 9, 2008. And during the next 2 hours, I'm going to be speaking with two fascinating guests. We live in such exciting times, and I think these two gentlemen can help us figure out at least partially what the heck is happening. During the first hour, I have Professor Stan Leibowitz of the University of Texas at Dallas to talk about the mortgage meltdown and related economic matters. And in hour two, I have Andrew Johnson from Derbyshire, England, who, among other claims to fame, is an expert on 9/11 research and activism. Let me introduce our first guest, Stan Leibowitz, who's Ashbel Smith Professor of Economics at UTD. He does research in two principal areas. One is intellectual property rights, and another is network effects, path dependence, and the Microsoft case and related matters. And I got to tell Stan that I think he, in the economics profession, gained some fame and notoriety because of his famous article called The Fable of the Keys that came out in 1990 in the Journal of Law and Economics, co-authored with Stephen E. Margolis. And that was basically refuting the claim that the Dvorak keyboard was superior to the QWERTY keyboard. And because this was often cited as an archetypal case where markets got it wrong and were stuck on the wrong standard, and they, I think, refuted that quite well. Stan, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Morgan.
And did you notice a jump in your earnings or more? Emails were pretty rare back then, I guess, but some fame that was attached to that article?
The keyboard article?
Yeah.
Well, there was a jump, but it took quite a few years because, you know, we did the keyboard article, and then we did several other papers on path dependence and network effects.
Yeah.
And then the Microsoft case came along, and that was the theory that was behind at least the initial claims that the government was making. And so we got a lot of attention, and it was fun. We got to drive around Manhattan one day in a limo speaking to people.
Where in Seattle? Washington?
No, Manhattan. Manhattan.
Oh, okay.
There was some consulting, so I just some money was made out of it. But that's sort of gone away now, basically.
Well, the Microsoft case has died down, hasn't it? Been resolved.
Yeah.
In Europe, I think, was resolved. They just extracted some money out of Billy and Company and made some competitors quiet, I guess. The main reason I've got Stan on is that he has just come out with a new policy report for the Independent Institute out in Oakland, California, very timely, called Anatomy of a Train Wreck, Causes of the Mortgage Meltdown. And let me just play something to you, Stan, and the listeners. I see that there was a banned Saturday Night Live skit, but this is available. And I'm going to play a minute and a half segment of this. And I think I'm going to get Stan Leibowitz's reaction to this because it relates very directly to his policy study of the mortgage meltdown. And this first comedian is playing Nancy Pelosi. So let me kick this, start this up.
In the past few weeks, this debate has focused on the wisdom of government intervention in the housing market. What hasn't been talked about is that behind every home foreclosure, there is a story of real suffering by real Americans. People who, but for the grace of God, could be you or your neighbors. And today, we'd like to introduce you to some of them. Michael McCune and Jerome Gantz, two ordinary Americans whose only crime was to play by the rules, and who now find themselves facing eviction from their homes. Please tell us your story.
Well, to start, I still don't understand how this happened to me. I mean, I fit all the requirements for a subprime mortgage. No credit history. Same here. No job. Maybe a minor criminal record.
Ditto.
Dishonorable discharge from the Army.
Yeah, I got mine right here.
Yeah. Drug problem.
Me too.
Alcohol problem.
You'll be a sir.
Gambling addiction.
Yeah.
Pregnant girlfriend. Actually, two pregnant girlfriends.
Just the one.
Well, anyway, I was talking to a balloon mortgage where you move into the house and then you get to live in it. And you don't have to, like, pay money or anything to the bank, but then later you do.
Yeah, what up with that?
Yeah. I mean, you could say I'm a double victim since I've never had a job and now I don't have a home.
Well, I'm a triple victim because I've also been charged with arson for allegedly setting fire to the house they evicted me from.
You are both in our fault. Thank you. This is Greg Phillips. And his wife, Judy. How did the housing market collapse?
Well, my wife and I bought 24 timeshare condos, which we heavily mortgaged, in order to flip them 6 months later for triple the purchase price, and then the real estate market tanked.
And you were doing this through... Misrepresentation. I know I meant to do this out of your home or... Out of greed.
Yes, out of greed.
There it is, Stan.
I'm sorry I missed it. That was pretty funny.
Yeah. Supposedly this was banned. It's certainly politically incorrect. They go through three sets of troubled mortgages of different kinds, and that really matches up with your serious study of what happened. It wasn't just the defaults and foreclosures on the subprime market, but also, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the prime market default rate rocketed up from a much lower base, but roughly the same kind of jump.
Right. The prime and subprime had virtually the same jump in terms of percentage terms at the same time. And if you then separate out the primes and the subprimes into the adjustable and the fixed, they again have exactly the same pattern. The adjustable primes are the ones that had the big increase in foreclosures, and the adjustable subprimes had the big increase in foreclosures. So the subprime-prime distinction that most everybody who's been talking about the mortgage problem has been focusing on, and the claim being that it's just the subprimes, is not really the key distinction between the mortgages that are foreclosing and the mortgages that aren't. It's whether they're adjustable or not that really is the differentiator between those that where we've seen a big increase in foreclosures.
And one of the interesting findings that you came up with is the media and analysts talk as if there was a contagion that spread from the subprime default foreclosure fiasco to the primes. And you're finding, no, that's not what happened at all.
That's right. They both happened at exactly the same time, which was the third quarter of 2006 is when you started to have this very sharp increase in foreclosures. And, of course, what happened just before that? Well, in the second quarter of 2006 is when you stopped having an increase in house prices. And that's when they first started to turn. And it was, it stopped going up, and it was hardly down at all. It was down 1% or so in the next few quarters. Then, of course, it started to drop much more dramatically.
Okay, more about the housing meltdown and our economic troubles from Stan Leibowitz after the break. Sir. And my guest the first hour is Professor Stan Leibowitz, economist at UTD. Next hour, I have Andrew Johnson from Derbyshire, England, on 9/11 issues. And Stan, we go back to this mortgage meltdown. 2006 was the turning point. We could say that the bubble burst. And the reason to get this so right, and your study is so important, is much bigger than the housing market per se. And I want to read a couple things to you by from Dr. Kurt Rickenbacker, who died last year. But in a column he wrote on December 15, 2006, he referred to the Associated Credit expansion as bizarre, that this housing bubble, he said, was outpacing all past experience by far, and he claimed that the numbers showed total mortgage debt in the U.S. was $4.8 trillion in 2000, so this had been accumulated or built up after many decades, and it jumped, nearly doubled, to $9.3 trillion by the second quarter of 2006. And what makes this so important to understand and find out what happened is that he says that private households were withdrawing equity. And they, quote, stampeded as never before into debt to finance additionally other kinds of spending. That the whole economy, he says, developed into an outright bubble economy, unquote. And then finally he says that in the preceding year, in 2005, about a third of the increase in consumer spending depended on mortgage borrowing. So there, this whole business about using your house as an ATM with seconds and the like. Well, it just got crazy, didn't it?
Yeah, it was definitely crazy. It was, you know, we have these bubbles from time to time. The problem was that we had a bubble on the biggest asset that we have. So we're talking about a really big piece of the economy. And when that gets a bubble, it's more serious than when NASDAQ had its bubble, because NASDAQ was just not that important to the economy as housing is. You know, what's missing, and people see that there's a bubble. Everyone knows it ex post now. What they don't understand, though, I think, is really where the bubble came from at all. And that's sort of like the missing ingredient in trying to figure out what caused all of this in the first place. And that is that the government wanted to increase
the government. Doesn't, if it's a big economic disaster, doesn't it always trace back to the federal government in some form or another and the Federal Reserve? You know, it's just,
I'm not sure. I'm such a strong absolutist that I would say every problem is due to the government. I'll make myself more of a moderate than that.
After my own heart.
Yeah. But in this case, there was a very serious policy, and it sounded, you know, reasonable on the surface. They wanted to increase home ownership, and they succeeded. Home ownership went up after a 25-year period of being flat. Home ownership went up what was an enormous degree for something that moves as glacially as that. It went from 64% of households to 69% of households in this 10-year period.
So that 5 percentage points is millions of new households that are, have home ownership.
Right.
I don't know what the number would be, but it'd be, you know, something like 4 million or something increase.
Yeah, well, that's right, 4 or 5 million, because it's pretty close to 100 million households.
So you're really pushing on the margin of well, should we say prompt payment and affordability and the whole thing, especially when the these prices are going up at such rapid rates.
Well, you can understand you can understand why the prices are going up so rapidly. You got all these new people coming into the home market. Normally, there'd be people entering the market because there's always new people getting born, and there are more of them than there are dying, and so the population keeps increasing, and we have new households forming. And I think households tend to form at about 1 million a year during that period of time. But now we have this new 500,000 a year group coming in. So there's a 50% increase over the normal group of new people coming in to buy houses. So you have a home building industry that's sort of set up for this 1 million new people entering the market a year. And all of a sudden there's a 50% surge. And that's been,
and I think the didn't the new housing starts hit over 2 million a year at one point? You know,
yeah,
they're
I
just
think
really
that.
Resources being sucked into the housing industry.
Yes, yes. The house prices all went up because, you know, that's simple supply and demand. Demand goes up, so does the price. And at some point, speculation became a key element, and that's what that Saturday Night Live skit was about. But you know, there was a real live story in the Wall Street Journal that I thought was maybe not quite as amusing as the Saturday Night Live skit. Well, it was pretty good. It was about this guy in California who was annoyed that his credit was getting dinged. And his history was he delivered water. He was like an Ozarka water guy. And they don't get paid all that much money when you drive around with the truck and deliver that stuff. But he and his wife had purchased two $600,000 houses in California. And they had used the newer mortgages that allow you to make up any number you want on your income. So they lied about their income. And they were intending, because there were only two of them, they didn't need a second house. They had purchased a second house purely for speculation and to make money on it. And they had done this in the past. And then, of course, the housing prices stopped going up. And he didn't have the money to pay for the second house. He was renting it out, but the renters couldn't cover the
mortgage payment.
Yeah. And so he had to wind up, they went into foreclosure. And he's being interviewed, and he's mad at the bank. He said, I was one of their best customers. Look at all the mortgages I got from them, and they're dinging my credit history now. And he thought it was terrible.
Well, yeah, don't some politicians point to the predatory mortgage loan industry as being, you know, sucking all these people into this with these back-ended or balloon-type mortgage, and, you know, the silly borrowers were just taken as if they were children, right?
Right, and there's always some old people or some people who shouldn't be in a market who are truly sad stories and were taken advantage of. But it's not like that's any different now than it was 5 or 10 years ago. You find some of that in every industry, and you find some of that in, you know, economists do that. Everybody.
Yeah.
There
are recourses, but yeah,
right.
wasn't the main story. So we
that's
will
right.
be back with Stan Leibowitz, more about the mortgage meltdown after the break. My guest this first hour is Professor Stan Leibowitz of UTD, who's done a very important study on the mortgage meltdown. And Stan, everybody agrees that the second quarter of 2006 finally was the peak, and we went down from there. Let me give you this columnist. He's my favorite left-wing columnist in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. And it's Gene Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S, Gene Lyons. The headline in his column from Wednesday is GOP's latest ugly fable. And he says in part, now come GOP apologists to identify the real perps of the Wall Street meltdown. Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, feckless black folks, Mexican Americans, and U.S. Representative Barney Frank, who's evidently been covertly running Wall Street all this time. And lots of other clever talk, but he points to conservative pundits such as Charles Krauthammer, Jeff Jacoby, Laura Ingraham, Ann Coulter. And he does mention the 1977 law known as the Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA, which you mentioned in your study as part of the pressure and regulation to increase home ownership primarily among the low-income household population. And Lyons doesn't believe a word of this, and he doesn't have a theory of his own, but he says an alert child would wonder why a 31-year-old law suddenly started causing trouble in 2008. So what would the Community Reinvestment Act, why would it suddenly act up in 2006 through 2008?
Well, it was changed in 1995, and that's mm-hmm. the key. People point out to say, well, it was 1977 is when it was passed, and that's true. But that's largely irrelevant because for practical purposes, it didn't have much impact on mortgages. What it said was banks should try hard to make sure that they gave mortgage to everyone who was deserving and that they not discriminate against minorities, which is perfectly fine. What they changed in 1995 was how you would measure how the bank was doing. So all of a sudden it wasn't good enough for the bank to be trying to get everybody who deserved a mortgage to have one. It wasn't good enough to go into minority neighborhoods and let them know that the mortgages were there and they should come and give their applications and that you would try to treat them as fairly as possible. That was no longer good enough. You had to actually achieve success in providing mortgages to the neighborhoods that were the poorer and more minority neighborhoods. And so that really changed the nature of it, because to actually increase the number of mortgages beyond a certain point, which is now it's something more like a quota, you have to start lowering the standards, because it turns out the banks weren't getting enough minority mortgages according to those criteria, using normal banking underwriting standards. And so what they started to do is basically require lower down payments and allow them to get mortgages even though the payment was a higher percentage of their income, and start including things for income, you know, categories of income that otherwise normally wouldn't have been included. So you might include welfare payments, or you might include
unemployment.
Unemployment, things that are temporary, yes.
Yeah.
That, you know, you have a 30-year mortgage, you're not going to be able to keep paying that out of your, you know, temporary unemployment payments. So now this wasn't only a case where they said, now you're going to have to perform. They also said the Boston Fed came out with a manual telling banks how they should go about providing mortgages, particularly in these type of areas. And they specifically said, you know, you can't expect these people to come up with down payments on their own, so you should either allow other forms of down payments, such as allowing the builder to provide it, or come up with something else, let the government give some sort of basically charity fund, and we'll give them the down payment. And so the Boston Fed manual provided instructions on how to do this. And banks were told they better do it, if you go back to the newspapers in 1993 and 1994 and 1995, there were just big stories every few weeks in one of the major newspapers about bankers discriminating, and they were being brought up by the Justice Department, as possibly they'll be charged. They were not allowed to engage in mergers and acquisitions, which was a big deal to an industry that was undergoing a lot of structural change. So the bankers came on board and basically agreed to make those changes, and then it became part of the program to increase home ownership. And a lot of that home ownership was to come from the minority and poor groups, because other people were getting houses on their own before. The Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were drawn into this. They were a big part. They agreed to make 42% of their funds available for poor and minority homeowners. And there were various times where they were threatened that they should force it to be 50% that they were making available. But they essentially made $1 trillion available. That was the number they had. And I think they said in 1994, 95, that's when the big push started to increase home ownership. And they met it early, their $1 trillion pledge. And then they renewed it in 1999 to 2000, and they were going to have a $2 trillion that they were providing to poor and minority homeowners. Now, there were a bunch of things that happened over time. And in the end, it's not the case that banks were being forced in 2006 to make loans to marginal customers. And so in that sense, the critics of this, you know, of the conservatives like me, who are saying that it is those laws that cause the problems, I mean, they have a point, but they're missing the picture. We're not saying that these days those old, you know, forcing banks to reduce their restrictions was why the restriction, you know, it's forcing them to do it now. But that's why they loosened up. Because they were pushed.
Well, there's such an incestuous relationship that grew there, you know, from initially the gun and intimidation to everybody's on board when you're in a bubble.
Right,
it kind of worked because these marginal borrowers are enjoying the price appreciation. And it wasn't until the second quarter of 2006 when that rises in price stopped that, it's like Warren Buffett says, you know, you don't know who's swimming naked till the tide goes out.
Right. Right. You took away the next part of my story, but that's fine. I'm glad you anticipated it. Okay, we're about to run out of time.
Whatever follows, try this on, Stan. This may be a little bit of premature, but there was a story in the paper this morning, headline, for 1 in 6, home loan exceeds sale value. So in other words, this bust can, you know, the drip, drip, drip continues. 1 in 6 mortgage holder is, quote, underwater or upside down. So there's going to be a lot more walkaways. although this latest bailout bill apparently has some provision to come in and step in and help everybody who's in arrears.
Yeah,
Stan?
Okay. Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
That's right. I guess I wanted to fill in one or two little holes in the story, though, about why the critics of the anti-CRA are sort of wrong. What the Boston Fed provided was sort of like a bad story. The power of bad information.
Yeah, we'll get
anyway,
back
we're
to
breaking
that
up.
Story with Stan Leibowitz on the mortgage meltdown on the other side of the break. This is the Dynamic Duo. Week. I am Morgan Reynolds, your guest host today, Thursday, and I have two excellent guests. This first hour, economist Stan Leibowitz of UT Dallas on the mortgage meltdown, and in the next hour, Andrew Johnson, and we will talk 9/11. Stan, on the other side of the break, you were saying, in effect, that the role of this Community Reinvestment Act and other interventions is misunderstood?
Yeah, that's right. What happened in the 90s was two things. One was the opening up the Pandora's box of convincing banks that they should make loans with weaker underwriting standards. And then there was the power of a bad idea. And that idea was that these underwriting standards were really okay, and the old underwriting standards really didn't serve any purpose. Economists deserve blame for this because they were involved in arguing that, in fact, the standards were unnecessary. And these were economists who were working at various banks such as the, Boston Fed or at some of
the
government agencies.
And they sponsored the study that was
that's
so
right. They
important.
They did the study on mortgage discrimination, and then they did the pamphlet on how not to discriminate in your lending. So that idea took hold, and it wound up being important because the question was, well, you could test it. When they gave these mortgages, how did they wind up performing? And this is where the unfortunate timing. We got the bubble, and the bubble hides bad mortgages. Because when the housing prices are going up 10% a year, no one needs to default or get foreclosed. Because all they have to do is refinance or sell the house at a profit. And so you didn't see the defaults that you might have expected from the lower lending standards. And they said, see, we were right. And they convinced a lot of people that, in fact, they were right. And that opened up the floodgate to the loans being made and people buying them. And that's where it all became. Yeah, now it's voluntary. The banks are happy to make them and they're happy to sell them. And investors were happy to buy them and the rating agencies were giving them good ratings. And they were all ignoring the fact that they were basing it now on data that was created during a bubble and is not really going to give you a result that's going to be true in a normal equilibrium. And that was a big mistake, but it was,
You did a study that re-examined their data, et cetera, and found that there hadn't been any discrimination prior to all this regulatory
reform. That's right.
In
1998, we published an article saying that the numbers that the Boston Fed was using, they had never bothered to look at the raw data. And there were so many clerical errors that had been made in putting this data set together that it was virtually worthless. We also had the good fortune to write in that paper in 1998 that because of this study that the Boston Fed did, we have all this loosening of lending standards occurring, and it's going to lead to an increase in defaults. And it's going to wind up having the opposite effect from what they claim they want, which is to increase home ownership and help poor people. They're going to wind up making them get foreclosed out of their homes. Now, the bubble hid that for a while.
Right.
But then it wound up coming
but
to the
now
floor.
You're validated. I mean, there's no question that a disaster was created. And before our segment is up here, our last segment, I want to bring up two more issues that are a couple steps beyond your very important study on the mortgage meltdown, and that is to bring up this newspaper headline, 1 in 6 home loans now exceed the sale value of the house. One
right.
in six. So
lots of loans were made in the last couple of years. Yeah.
And the defaults and or foreclosures. So are you of the mind, of course, we economists hate people asking us to predict, but let's go ahead and do it anyway. You know, over the next year or two, shouldn't these prices continue to decline? It doesn't look like we've reached market clearing.
Actually it's the decline is slowing down.
Yeah.
Now, whether it's temporary or not, it's hard to say. But it was really strong 3 and 4 quarters ago. It was dropping at 2.5% a month at that point. It's down to somewhat less than half of that in the last quarter and a half. So it seems like it's slowing. And
so it might bottom out conceivably within 12 months or
something.
Yeah,
if I had to bet on it, and I'm not sure I would be willing to put a lot on it, I think it's going to bottom in 2009.
Okay.
And so I think the housing prices will sort of, that skid will come to an end.
You know, there's one unmentioned great thing about this, and that is, housing is going to more housing than a couple of years ago is within reach of people with modest incomes.
That's right. We have more houses than people can afford with traditional underwriting standards, and so we need to have lower prices. And we're approaching a point where we're getting much closer to what the price in real dollars was before the bubble began. And I think we're likely to reach that in 2009. And if we don't overshoot badly, that should basically be the end of the price decline, which is what's wrong with some of the plans now, which is we've already had a big decline. People who can afford their mortgage are walking away because it's a bad investment. So that's a certain percentage. But that's already done. Those who've walked or couldn't afford it, they're foreclosed, they're out. What we don't know with this, with the bad mortgage-backed securities is how much of the decline in price is due to what's already happened versus how much of it's due to what's expected even further in the future. If a lot of it's due to what's already happened, then bailing out current homeowners isn't going to do very much at all for the value of those securities. That's a problem with any of these, proposals that work on the home ownership end.
Right. I mean, all this really reflected a distorted structure of production and malinvestment from an Austrian school point of view. And the losses are there. And, most of these houses are going to be occupied ultimately. But the real wild card here is how the losses are distributed from these mistaken investments. And you cannot bail out the stock market and all these other things in truth.
Well, no one's talking. This is the thing about it. You know, we have homeowners who've lost a lot of money, and they made a bad investment. You know, the people in the stock market the last week have lost more money than the homeowners have. No one is talking about bailing them out, and they shouldn't be talking about bailing them out, but there's not much difference in my mind to a homeowner. That's a big investment.
Right.
And somebody else who happens to own the stock. Most of these home loans are supposed to be recourse loans. There are a few states that don't have recourse, California being one of them. Because Martin Feldstein mentioned this in his piece last week, but he said most of them are non-recourse, and my understanding is that's wrong. But that's de jure. According to the law, it's recourse, but in reality, nobody goes after anyone. So if you can afford the home and you can afford the payments, but it's underwater and you walk away, you can mail your keys in, and yeah, you get a little ding in your credit history, but no one's coming and making you pay what you technically owe. And they could legally do that. That's a big question that no one seems to be facing. Should we be enforcing that? Because everybody has this idea that all these homeowners are these poor people who have tried and strived mightily to make their mortgage payments, but economic conditions are such that they just can't do it, and so they're having to leave their house and they're crying on the way out. And there may be some like that, but there's also a fair number who were buying multiple houses and putting very little down and cashing in. You know, a lot of people made money the last 10 years when the housing prices were going up, and some of them were still holding those houses when it left. And we're going to let them make all this money going up and then bail them out going down?
Right. capitalize those profits, privatize them, and socialize the losses. What a country.
Right.
Hey, thanks so much, Professor Stan Liebowitz of UTD, for coming on and explaining what actually happened with the mortgage meltdown. Thank you so much.
All right. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you, Stan. And we'll be back the other side of the break and news break with Andrew Johnson from Derbyshire, England.